Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will speak with experts about pharmacy benefit managers and summer pet safety. He'll also have an update on Ohio's farms. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective,
Ohio House Bill 276 could expand the role of pharmacy benefit managers, otherwise known as PBMs, in a federal drug discount program meant to help low-income patients. But there are serious concerns that the bill could have unintended consequences for local hospitals, clinics, and families who rely on affordable medications. Antonio Chacha, the nation's leading expert on PBMs, based right here in Columbus, Ohio, joins us now on Columbus Perspective to explain how this bill could impact those of us right here in Central Ohio. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
It's our privilege. When was the bill introduced and what is its current status?
The bill was introduced earlier this year, and it is currently being debated within the Ohio legislature. It has had a few hearings, and it seems to have some momentum, much like other bills of its kind that have passed in other states and even been signed into law. So I think it does have a realistic chance of passing, given some of the momentum in the other states.
For those of us who may not be familiar with those three letters, what is the role of a pharmacy benefit manager or a PBM?
So the PBM is a necessary market friction in some ways, right? We all know that drug prices are inflated in the United States, correct? And the finger of blame often goes to the manufacturers, but it's not just them, right? They sell drugs to wholesalers like Cardinal Health in our backyard. And those drugs get sold to pharmacies who then sell them to patients and the employers and government programs working on their behalf. So every layer of that supply chain wants to make more money, right? So who's going to push back? Well, we brought in PBMs years ago, first to just transact the claim, but then we later said, hey, if you're processing all these claims on behalf of insurance companies, maybe you PBM can actually start negotiating and pushing back on the prices that everybody else wants to charge. All of that sounds great, right? It's a good balancing act. The problem evolved over time that PBMs use that role in the middle to become another mouth to feed. So they successfully have been working to negotiate really low costs with manufacturers and pharmacies. But the rub has been when they mark them up and then resell them back to the patients and the plan sponsors they're supposed to be working for. So in many ways, they're the arsonists and firefighters of high drug prices. They negotiate bigger discounts, but then they slap their own big markups on top of them and then become part of the problem.
A similar process to wholesale and then to distributor and then to retail. So what happens to the 340 drug discount program if this bill actually becomes law? And how's that going to affect our out-of-pocket patient costs?
Yeah, so in the United States, there is $356 billion, capital B billion, of discounts that manufacturers shave off the list prices of their drugs. And so think of it this way. There, we have bogus inflated list prices for drugs in the United States, and there are $356 billion worth of opportunity to lower our exposure to those bloated prices. The 340B program is one of many discount programs that makes up that $356 billion pot of money. The premise of the program is that drug companies sell their drugs at deeply discounted rates to hospitals and federally qualified health centers, with the idea being that they buy those drugs at the discounted rate, but then sell them at massive markups and use the profits generated to cover other healthcare services that are not being paid for by patients. So think of it as people who can't afford them. That might sound good, right? We're using drug money to try to pay for things that patients can't afford. The problem is that the premise of the program is built on selling something at a massive markup and using that markup and the spreads from that to pay for something else. Well, who pays the inflated amount? Who is the subsidy for that program? That is the patient. That is you and I. That is the employer. That's the government program who's essentially paying that markup to provide something for somebody else. So it exacerbates our inflated prices in the United States and is built on the premise that somebody must be overcharged in order to generate the value that goes to somebody else. Expanding that 340B program can provide greater access to care for those who can't afford it. But the asterisk on that is that it requires somebody else to be overcharged in order to generate that subsidy in the first place. And PBMs live in the middle where they're transacting these claims and own their own specialty pharmacies that are working to put their hands in that pot of money and not pass that value on either to the patient who's being overcharged for their drugs, nor for the patient who's getting the benefit of the overcharge by having their services paid for. So expanding the program gives PBMs a greater opportunity to dip into that $356 billion pot of money without any value accruing to the end payer of the prescription.
So for folks that are listening to this, first of all, this is a lot, and people are probably going to want to go to a website to do some reading and research on their own. So let's first ask, what is the best website that can give us a layman's overview of what we've discussed in the last 7 minutes?
Well, the first thing I recommend is an organization called the Drug Channels Institute that talks about what we call this gross to net bubble, this $356 billion pot of money that is the difference between overpaying and getting a reasonable price for a medicine. Understanding that the bloated prices are there intentionally, and then knowing where those discounts are going, which includes the 340B program and PBMs, all of that ultimately lives within there. Beyond that, there isn't a lot of resources in this space on 340B, largely because it is a very non-transparent program. The entire premise is that somebody buys a drug for a hidden price, sells it at a bloated price, and pockets the difference. And as you might imagine, they don't want people knowing how much money they're pulling out of that system. So there is an investigation conducted by the U.S. Senate, Bill Cassidy out of Louisiana. There is an investigation that was published within the last few months that is a very long screed, but it gives a complete overview of how the 340B program is working and all the intermediaries that are pulling money out of that pot.
The average citizen, what can he or she do to take action, or is it simply out of the public's hands at this point in time?
Yeah, this becomes the challenge, right? Because when you or I or anybody else listening is lamenting the cost of their medicines, right? They're sitting around their kitchen table wondering how they're going to afford their medicines. Nobody's sitting there saying, what are the PBMs up to now? Or how is the 340B program impacting the cost of the pharmacy counter? All they see is their drug pricing reality, right? The one that they see at the pharmacy counter. Unfortunately, there are so many things that lead to that bloated cost at the pharmacy counter that are not visible or readily understood to the average consumer. And so what I recommend to folks who are sitting there saying, dude, I'll never figure this out, I'm turning the dial, is if you have a drug affordability problem, the biggest thing that you could do is, A, make sure that you're shopping around. But from a policy perspective, advocate for the simplification of our drug pricing transactions. The more complex, the more sub-transactions, the more discounts and rebates, those are all opportunities for intermediaries, brokers, consultants, middlemen, whatever you want to call them, to put their hand in the cookie jar and get a little bit of cream off the top. And then just when you think they're getting a little, tomorrow they're getting a lot more. So by streamlining that transaction and making the transaction more efficient and less complex, we can all benefit from actually getting lower prices and less risk for being overcharged.
Sounds like we need to do some homework and we need to take action. We want to thank Antonio Chacha for being with us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on the Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
In Columbus, there are more than 35 urban farms, a number that's on the rise. Statewide, Ohio has roughly 74,000 farms with roughly 80,000 operators. For decades, these farmers have relied upon research and data to ensure successful grow seasons. The Make America Healthy Again movement, headed by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., is now calling that research into question. Tad Nicholson is the executive director of the Ohio Corn and Wheat Growers Association and joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning, Jay. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Tad, what were the key findings in the department's report?
Well, the report is broad, as you know, but what we were really focused on is some of the claims about pesticides, herbicides, products that we use to protect plants once we put them in the ground. And we've used them for decades. And by decades, I mean 10 decades. And this is something that has been a part of growing corn, wheat, soybeans in Ohio forever. And so we're really focused on those, and the safety of those products are very important to our members. Farmers that utilize these products want to make sure that they're not only protecting the plants, but protecting their families and themselves and the environment. And so the science behind this is very important to us. The MAHA report came out with some reports that we just don't agree with. I mean, that they put some doubt into the safety of those, and it's really not even their purview. It's really all this science is done by the EPA, and so they have a very stringent process that we believe in, but the MAHA report tended to come out with casting some doubt about safety of the products that we're producing, and we just have a lot of concern about that.
Well, let's look at this from the balcony view. What are considered safe pesticides for Ohio farming?
You know, anything that you see on the shelf has gone through a gauntlet of testing by the U.S. EPA. If you review that process, it is unbelievable the amount of testing for human health, plant health, animal health, the environment. It goes through testing to make sure that it is absolutely safe to use before the EPA will allow anybody, a farmer or a homeowner, to use any kind of a pesticide or a herbicide. And so we believe that that process, we kind of grumble about how stringent it is. It takes too long to get some of these products. But in the end, we believe it. It's science-based, and we see this as something that is important for us as farmers to make sure that we're safe and the environment is safe. So all of these products, but two particular products that the MAHA report will point out are glyphosate and atrazine. We've used these products for 60 years, and it's been tested by the EPA multiple times. It's not just once. It's not just when they first come out with a product. It goes through a re-review on a periodic basis, and products like atrazine have gone through 6 or 8 different reviews during that time period, all of which come out and say it is safe for the environment, it's safe for people, it's safe for animals, and we should continue using it.
So, Tad, what happens if these two elements become regulated or, God forbid, outlawed?
We look at these products as protection, and it's really part of our strategy to become more sustainable farming. So we don't till as much today as we did in the past because we have tools that help us to control weed pressure and those type of things that we used to use tillage to do. Tillage worked, but it also resulted in a lot of soil erosion. We were able to reduce that soil erosion, becoming more sustainable in our farming practices by adding in tools that are safe, but also do the job of tillage, and that's a herbicide.
What is the potential impact to Ohio farmers from a report like this? What does it mean for your typical farmer, one of those 74,000 farms that we talked about?
That's a good question, and it's something important to note that this report, and you see it in the news, and you probably reported on it, that it's getting a lot of shots taken at it. There are some doubts in the report that it's got some of the studies that it's citing were generated by AI, and some of those reports that you all heard coming out, and you might think, well, it's kind of a joke report. It's actually not. It's a precursor to a second report that's going to come out in August that will have policy implications. That's why we as farmers are focused on this, to make sure that we are monitoring that entire process so that it doesn't result in adverse regulations on farmers that are not rooted in sound science. And that's our biggest concern.
So when you are sitting back and you're waiting for August and seeing what is going to happen, what could the potential impact be for the corn and wheat industry in Ohio?
Well, so first of all, we're not going to sit back and wait on anything. There's one of the things that we had a real problem with this first report was they didn't consult agriculture at all. Nobody in agriculture had any kind of input into the science behind this. So our request has been, and it still is, to include agriculture in the report, and so they understand, you know, what's our side of things and understand the amount of science that has gone into the testing of herbicides and pesticides. If they were successful, and to your question, if they actually did take some of these products off the market, what it would do is raise food prices. It would cost more to raise food in the United States. We would use things, other tools that would result in us being less sustainable than we are today. So then the environment's going to be hurt. The food prices are going to be hurt. There's and all for reasons that are non-science based. And that's the problem. If these were truly, if the science was correct and it said we shouldn't be using these, farmers would be the first ones to say, let's stop using them. But it's not. It's really a group of almost activists that are inside the HHS and the MAHA Commission that have really kind of made some claims that we just don't agree with. We know that they're not science-based because we have science that has proven on the opposite side. So there's a lot at stake here. And we as Americans, I think, should be focused on this because the concept of making America healthy again is a sound one. We all want to be healthy. But if you don't use sound science behind this, there are unintended consequences that everyone's going to feel.
So many farmers voted for the current administration. That's a fact. Do Ohio farmers feel abandoned by the administration when a report like this comes out with those potential consequences on the table?
No, I wouldn't say they feel abandoned. They certainly have had questions about Secretary Kennedy from the beginning because of he was very public about his stances on this these topics prior to when he was running for president. We all knew what he was about and what he stood for, and so it's not too surprising that as he's taken over HHS that this is happening. But there is a counterbalance here, and this is in Secretary Rollins. We count on her to stand up for agriculture, and so the administration's balanced, and they're going to have conversations about this, and we trust that in the end that there will be some sound science that really is the foundation of all of these decisions. But this report was enough concerning enough that certainly we just can't stay quiet about it, and we need to speak up on behalf of Ohio farmers.
So I want you to get out your crystal ball, Tad, and tell me, what does the future look like for Ohio's agricultural industry in general?
Well, you know, we are so blessed to live in an area of the world that has soils and climate and weather and water that enable us to raise crops in a profitable way and way more than we could ever use ourselves. And so we are blessed to be here, and it's a responsibility that we take, and we're lucky, I think, to be in this area. So the future is bright. I mean, it's a good area for us to farm in. We can play our role in growing food for a growing world population, and we take that job very seriously. And it's an old profession, and it's going to be an old profession for a long time, Jay. This is something that Ohio has as its root. Agriculture and food production is Ohio's number one industry. And a lot of people don't realize that because not a lot of people farm, but there's a whole lot of people that are involved with the food and the agriculture industry. industry supporting that production of food. And so that's what makes agriculture and food production Ohio's number one industry. So you're not going to abandon that. It's going to be a bright future, Jay.
There's a lot of misinformation out there, Tad. So if somebody's listening to this interview and they say, I want to learn more, I want to know where I can get that information, where do we send them?
You know, we would love for your listeners to visit our website at ohiocornandwheat.org. And you're right. We do want to put out a lot of information, the truth and the science and that's behind all of our agriculture, but also food production. And so please visit ohiocornandwheat.org. We would love to have anyone interested visit that website.
Now, my friend in Georgia says Georgia sweet corn's the best in the nation, but I have to challenge that. I think it's Ohio, especially in August. What do you think?
Jay, you know that's not true. Ohio is not only good at football, we are good at growing sweet corn. And so go ahead and enjoy that. We're about to enter that season, and I look forward to it as you do.
Especially when it comes from a roadside stand, because that's about as Ohio as it gets.
You bet.
That. All right. We want to thank Tad Nicholson from the Ohio Corn and Wheat Growers Association. And I'm Jay Fox for Columbus Perspective.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Here in Central Ohio, it's another blazing hot and humid summer. Unless we are in a cold pool, it's not a lot of fun for us humans to be outside. So imagine how your pets feel with all that fur. It's also been a wild weather ride with storms, flooding, and tornadoes, too, causing anxiety and danger for both humans and animals. That's why Dr. Sandra Fay, president of the American Veterinary Medical Association, joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with the heat. How hot is too hot for pets to be outside?
Well, first, it's really important to remember if it's hot for you, it's even hotter for your pet. So, you know, take that into consideration. Our friends, our pets follow us everywhere, right? So they're not necessarily going to show us if they're too hot. So it's important that we think for them and watch for signs and just make sure we keep them safe. It's hard to say how hot is too hot because every pet is different. Some of it depends on anatomy, if they have a swish in face. Some of it depends on if their age, if they have any health issues like diabetes, things like that, can all affect how they feel or react to heat. So bottom line is, if it's hot, keep them inside as much as you can. Exercise in the morning, exercise at night outside, but keep them inside. And if they have to get outside, shade and water.
Is panting a sign that we've let them stay outside too long, or is that just a natural reoccurrence?
Can be both. So we see dogs pant all the time, and sometimes they're excited, sometimes they're a little hot. So excessive panting and drooling are things we want to watch for. If they seem anxious, restless, just can't get comfortable, those are early signs as well. Once we, you know, other signs that we can see are vomiting, diarrhea. That's usually as it's progressed and gotten more severe. And they can even get to the point where they collapse. So again, if it's hot for you, it's even hotter for them. When in doubt, keep them inside.
How can we keep pets' paws from getting burnt on concrete and asphalt? Because that temperature on the concrete and asphalt is sometimes 20 to 40 degrees higher than the air temperature.
Absolutely. It can be pretty hot. So feel it when you're, if you have to be on concrete, or feel it and check it out, even if it's at night, because it can take a long time to cool off. But try and avoid it. If you can go on grass or, you know, gravel, that would be ideal. And there's booties, too. You can try that. Make sure to try it inside for a little while. Get them used to it, because it is something different for them, and they may react, you know, walk a little funny the first couple times you use them.
I don't think my miniature panther would enjoy booties. I don't think my arm would survive that attempt either.
Right? Yeah.
How should we alter our pets' food and water intake in these summer months?
So always have water around. I would, you know, you don't necessarily need to alter the food intake, except for you don't want to exercise after eating. So you can keep doing things similarly as long as you keep them inside and keep them cool.
And when it comes to storms, You know, pets are very intuitive. I once had a tuxedo cat, and we were able to tell the severity of the storm by her location during a storm. If she was under the bed, it was mild. If she was under the couch, it was medium. But if she was in the bathtub, that meant we needed to get to shelter.
Wow, smart cat.
Now, Aretha was the best. So how do we keep comfort for our pets during storms like this?
Yeah, so they can tell it's coming before we can very often, and I'm sure your cat gave you the signs before you even knew. And so if you have a pet that's anxious in storms, not all are, but if you do, definitely talk to your veterinarian. There's things you can do to help keep them calm. There's medications you can give, but the key is to give it before the storm starts, because once they're stressed, medicine often doesn't help. Make sure they have a safe place that they can go to. For your cat, it sounds like the safest is the tub. So make sure you provide them areas that they feel really comfortable. There's things like thunder shirts that often help. So talk to your veterinarian. Talk about how severe it is for your pet, how anxious it makes them, and come up with a plan, because there's different things that you can do.
We all go through, or should go through, emergency protocol preparation. So they tell us to put a plastic bag with all of our vital information and things of that nature, important papers. What do we do in terms of pet protocol in those kind of emergencies? How do we prepare for our pets in case there's a disaster like that?
Yeah, you said the most important word, prepare. Make sure you prepare ahead of time. And even if you're in an area where you don't think you might have a disaster, you're not in a hurricane area or tornado area, other disasters can happen. So it is key to be prepared. Think about what you use in a normal day, a normal week, and put those supplies aside. So food and extra food, medication, extra medication, because you never know how long you're going to be away from home. Bowls, collars, leashes. Make sure your pet is microchipped. Make sure that information is up to date, because when they get fearful, they often run. And so we want to make sure that if you're separated from them, that you can be reunited. So that microchip is key. And like you mentioned, make sure you have medical records, their vaccinations somewhere in an area that is quick, easy to get to, that you can just grab it and run.
And that microchip doesn't hurt them, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. It's vital for their safety if they ever should get lost.
Sandra Fay is the president of the American Veterinary Medical Association. We thank you for joining us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
The Ohio House will try to override Governor Mike DeWine's line item vetoes on property tax reform. The governor said he vetoed the line items to protect students and schools from the impacts of lost funding. The Senate would also have to override the vetoes with a 3/5 majority. The governor vetoed a line item that would have capped the amount of revenue school districts could carry over to the next year at 40%. Under the Republican plan, districts would have to give any amount over that back to property owners, with exceptions for capital improvement projects. The governor said he is forming a working group to come up with long-term solutions for property tax relief. 10TV sat down one-on-one with the governor and asked his thoughts on the House going into special session to take on his line item vetoes. He says it's part of the checks and balances, and the legislature has the right to come back if they really disagree with his decision.
You know, I vetoed those because I thought it was too much with virtually no warning to hit the schools. We have a property tax problem. It's the only tax that I hear people complain about, and they complain a lot to me about it. I'm sure they do to other to legislators as well.
As I mentioned, after his vetoes, the governor announced he's putting together a working group to tackle property tax relief. He's giving it 60 days to come up with recommendations for him and the legislature.
One is to take care of people who, let's say a 70-year-old couple, they've lived in their house, you know, for 30, 40 years. They pay their mortgage off, but now they live in an area where the value is going up dramatically and their taxes are going up. And they get to the point they can't even live in the house anymore. That's wrong. We have to help those individuals. At the same time, though, we have to be able to make sure that we have the tax base there for fire, EMS, for our schools. So there's a balance there to try to come up with.
The governor says whether both chambers override his vetoes or not, the working group will complete its task and make recommendations for property tax reform. In a statement after House Republicans announced the special session, Democratic House Minority Leader Dunny Isaacson said, quote, if Republicans were serious about real property tax relief, they wouldn't pass the buck. They would use this session to vote on bipartisan, common sense solutions that would make a real difference. Joining me now to talk about the special House sessions and the session and the issues being debated is Republican State Representative David Thomas. He is from Jefferson and represents portions of Ashtabula and Trumbull counties in Northeast Ohio. Representative Thomas is vice chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. Sir, thank you so much for making time this morning.
Thank you for talking about this issue. I really appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome. First of all, before we get into the nitty gritty, how often do you hear concerns from your constituents about property tax relief?
Every single day. This is the number one issue that I hear about, my colleagues hear about. This is why I actually ran for state representative. This is the number one issue in Ohio.
How badly needed is it, in your opinion?
It is something that we have to do now. This is why we're coming back from recess. It's why some of my colleagues actually canceled family trips abroad. It's what we have to focus on. And what we got in the budget was the things that very baseline, very just structural changes that are needed. We have to do a lot more. But just these reforms are absolutely vital.
You've been very vocal on social media, even holding some property tax relief teletown halls, urging veto overrides. Why do you believe what the House and Senate passed is the right way to go?
So this is the first step. This is essentially changing some of the structural issues with the property tax system as kind of our first layer that we can then build upon for additional reforms that are needed. These are things that were actually recommended out of the study committee that was done last year in the legislature. I was not a member, but I testified in front of the committee. We gave about 22 or so different reform ideas. These are some of those. We're putting them into action now. And these are kind of the things that we do. And then we do even stronger needed relief and reform efforts for our property owners.
The governor vetoed the measures over concerns it will hurt students and schools. Superintendents have expressed major concerns, especially over the 40% revenue carryover provision. How do you respond to the critics who say that that part of the plan will hurt schools?
The governor, I heard in the opening, said that this was kind of out of the blue for schools, then we'll have time to react. Anyone that receives a property tax bill knows that we've been growing in a crisis. And the fact that the legislature last year did a study committee, these were recommendations in the study committee, and then now we're actually acting on them, I think that's what we should be doing. We should actually be moving forward with needed reforms. So this is not out of the blue by any means. It was actually out of the blue that the vetoes occurred. So schools have known that changes need to happen. If you believe that our property owners are paying too much on their property tax bills, I think folks would then realize we need to actually lower those. And schools are the biggest chunk of the property tax bill. In terms of carryovers and cash, as we've seen quite literally billions and billions and billions more of our property payments being made then to our public schools. And if they're sitting on a good amount of that tax dollars that are not being spent, are just essentially gaining interest for the school, well, if we're in a crisis and our tax rates are too high, shouldn't we be essentially removing part of the tax to our property owners through some of the cash that's sitting there? And that's the Budget Commission provision, for example, allowing then every local entity to kind of see how much should actually be held in the bank, how much is really needed for those services. It just makes sense that government is not a piggy bank. And if government has too much money, it should be returned back to those who made those payments.
The schools, many of them argue that they've been good stewards of the money and they're holding it maybe for capital improvement projects down the line. And if money is given back to property owners, they might have to then call for more levies. We've heard that argument before. What do you think of that?
So I've frankly been very surprised that we're essentially going back and forth over local governments not wanting to actually ask their property owners for higher taxes. The money that's in bank accounts and the money that has been paid by our property owners really spiking over the last 5 years, the property owners did not approve that. That's part of higher property values and part of the tax bill being tied directly to those property values. So I don't think it's revolutionary at all to say, if you want significantly more money, you should be asking your voters, your property owners for that. I don't think that that's a bad way to run your government. And if anything, I think that builds trust with your taxpayers. What doesn't build trust is essentially continuing to force our property owners to pay higher and higher amounts every year and telling them, well, this is just what the system is and you've got to pay it over. That's not really helping the homeowners.
I believe you're talking also about the one part of the line item vetoes that he vetoed eliminating the authority for local governments and schools to pass emergency and replacement levies. So what would the alternative be for the needed funding if that were the case?
Transparency and taxation. So local governments will go to their voters and the voters will clearly see, is this a levy that's a new levy? It will increase my taxes. Or is this a levy that's a renewal levy and it'll keep my taxes the same? Removing all of that different kind of confusing and different types of language in levies that really don't directly tell the voter what's happening gives the voter that control and they'll know, do I want to increase my tax bill or would I like it to be the same? And the same goes for the 20 mil floor provision that he had vetoed as well. If the voters are approving taxes, all of that should be counted towards a minimum tax rate that the schools are guaranteed. We shouldn't be having minimum rates that spike and go up with values on top of additional levies and revenue the schools are receiving also.
Representative Thomas, how much are these legislative efforts motivated by the fact that a grassroots group is working to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot to abolish all property taxes in Ohio?
So I can tell you this is why I ran for the office. We were working on these reforms and these ideas before that effort. That effort is very real. I bring them up in every single local government conversation that I have by telling folks, you know, we're trying to reform the system to make it more relatable to the voters. There's a strong effort that's gained signatures in nearly every single county across the state. And if they're successful, which I couldn't blame the senior that the governor had mentioned for saying, this system is working against me, I'm just gonna get rid of it. I sympathize completely. So the fighting against these reform efforts by local governments really to me does not make sense because this is coming. The constitutional amendment will be on the ballot. I firmly believe that. And if that happens, you're gonna see a massive, massive change at the local level in how all of Ohio was really structured. And the same local governments that are saying you can't make any changes here, they don't know what they're gonna do on this side. So we're essentially asking, work with us, decrease your tax rates, try to rebalance everything, because I firmly believe that the constitutional amendment folks are legitimate, they're strong, and it speaks to the anger and frustration of our voters.
Do you believe that the veto override votes will be successful?
So I'm very optimistic. I know it will be tight. I can tell you I'm getting an email almost every 5 minutes from, you know, teachers and from different folks who don't want to see the system change, who want to continue to see spikes in unvoted property taxes. I think they're being told that, you know, these reform efforts will harm the ability to provide services and teach kids, and that's just not true. So I can't blame them for being worried. But there's a lot of pressure to try and keep the system the same. But at the end of the day, I think my colleagues remember that property taxes are the number one issue. When we were going door to door last year, This was brought up continually. And I'm very optimistic.
I don't know if you can answer this in only 20 or 30 seconds or not, but that's all the time we have left for this segment. I know you hear this question from voters. Isn't the lottery supposed to be paying for public schools? Can you explain that situation?
A video on my social media that explains this. The lottery brings in $1.5 billion every year. That profit goes towards public education. We spend as Ohioans roughly $30 billion on public education. the lottery is a drop in the bucket in terms of how much we spend. Clearly, we have a spending problem, not a revenue problem.
Representative David Thomas, thank you so much for making time with us this morning.
The Fan.
A court ruling is giving a sense of relief for the large number of Haitian immigrants in Springfield, even if that is temporary. A federal judge ruled the Trump administration cannot end temporary protected status for them in early September. I went to Springfield the other day to find out what the ruling means to the Haitian community right now and what's next.
A conversation, a comforting space, a connection to resources. That's what the Haitian Support Center offers Haitian immigrants who come here as they work to integrate into the workforce and the community. Executive Director Vilas Dorsonville says the court ruling is a reprieve for the estimated 12 to 15,000 Haitians in the Springfield area. In late June, Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem announced temporary protected status, or TPS, for Haiti would end on September 2nd. Immigrants could lose their right to work and be deported. Haiti has been plagued by gang violence and poverty since a catastrophic earthquake in 2010. DHS argued the conditions in Haiti had improved enough for Haitians to return home safely, and that temporary protected status is meant to be just that, temporary. A few days later, a federal judge ruled Noem does not have the authority to end TPS early, and that the most recent extension of TPS until next February 3rd will stand.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.